Welcome to the Northfield Candidate Show, an in-depth conversation with the people running for office in Northfield in 2024. Today, on a special wrap-up edition of the show, we welcome St. Olaf political science professor and the director of the St. Olaf Institute for Freedom and Community, Christopher Chapp. Here now are your hosts, Rich Larson and Joe Moravchik. Good morning, and welcome to KYMN Radio's wrap-up coverage of the 2024 election. I'm Rich Larson.
And I'm Joe Moravchik. On this program, from July through November, leading up to the election, we interviewed the candidates for the State House of Representatives, Northfield City Council and Mayor, Rice County Board of Commissioners, and the Northfield School Board. We wanted to talk with each candidate in a long-form interview and let them, in their own words, discuss with us their backgrounds, what drew them into politics, what the pressing challenges are that they see in our society, and what their goals are to meet those challenges.
So the election has, of course, taken place on November 6th. We learned who won each of our local elections. Christy Purcell will return to the State House, and Erica Zweifel will become our new mayor. Brad Ness, Chad Beamer, and Peter Dolan will be on the City Council in 2025. Corey Butler, Maggie Epstein, Amy Gerwitz, and Claudia Gonzalez-George will return to the school board. In Maggie Epstein's case, she will be a new member. And Jim Perfurst and Galen Malika returned to the Rice County Board of Commissioners. We have talked plenty on this program about our local elections. Today, however, we are going to talk about the national election for President of the United States with local St. Olaf College professor and all-around good guy, Christopher Chapp.
Professor Chapp teaches courses on research methodology and American political behavior at St. Olaf College. He received a BA in political science and English from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and his MA and PhD from the University of Minnesota, where he studied American politics with an emphasis in political psychology. His research interests include political communication, campaigns and elections, religion and U.S. politics, and the politics of class and inequality. Professor Chapp is the author of a book titled Religious Rhetoric and American Politics, The Endurance of Civil Religion and Electoral Campaigns and Moral Issues, How Public Opinion on Abortion and Gay Rights Shapes American Politics.
Our listeners will recognize Chris. He's a veteran of our program here on KYMN, working with us on election content, but also on our Public Policy This Week program, which discussed lots of policy, but almost no politics. Here today, we do talk about national politics. Professor Chapp, welcome.
Yeah, great to be here.
It's good to see you again, Chris. Thanks for being here.
Rich, before we get into our presidential election discussion, let's dig a little deeper and find out what is really important about our guest's background. Chris did undergrad at Wisconsin.
Oh, God, I'm outnumbered.
Grad school in Minnesota. Chris, Badger or Gopher Athletics, who do you root for? Got a big football game coming up here in a couple weeks.
Yeah, 100% Badger Athletics. I bleed red. So,
how do I even get along with you guys?
You're outnumbered in your own studio.
I know. It you kills know, me.
There's
well,
a reason you're attracted to guests like this.
This shows that I'm benevolent and I welcome all kinds. I am a bipartisan host. We welcome Gophers and Badgers.
Athletic diversity.
There it is, right there. All right. Let's talk about the presidential election. President-elect Donald Trump won 312 electoral votes and about 77 million votes all overall. Vice President Harris won 226 electoral votes and about 74 million votes overall. President Trump won both the Electoral College vote and the popular vote. Professor Chapp, first, did these results surprise you? Second, is this a governing mandate considering Republicans won the presidency, the House of Representatives, and the Senate in this election?
Well, surprise, no. I mean, we had this great talk, Rich, before the election, where we talked about the polls and polling, and I think the word I repeated like 1,000 times was uncertainty.
Yes.
And I think there were reasons for that, in part the economy, and we can talk about this more today, I'm sure we will, send some ambiguous signals, and economy really matters, and voting behavior, as we found out. Another reason is I don't think the polls were giving us a great signal, despite the consistency that the polls had running into the election. And the final thing I would say is typically when you see polling error, right? You tend to see it look exactly the same across every single county right. in America. And so, you know, if it was going to tip a little bit toward Trump in one place, I guess it doesn't remotely surprise me that it was going to tip that way in every single place.
Sure.
Leading up to the election, all the focus was on the swing states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, and Nevada. Polling had the races too close to call in many of these states. Harris leading in some of these states, Trump and others. Did you anticipate Trump sweeping Harris in the swing states? And on election night, were there early indicators for you, or even a day or two before the election, where you thought that the election night was going to be a great night for Trump and a disappointing night for Harris?
Well, yeah, I mean, so second question first. Yeah, as you started to see early returns come in, it became clear very early on that Harris was not getting the votes that she needed in key Democratic strongholds. Mm-hmm. And again, we can talk more about this. Part of that goes to turnout operations that we can talk about. She got far fewer votes than Biden got. Part of it goes to sort of that independent or swing voter, probably going Trump's way. But those folks seem to move in mass across, and we'll talk about some demographic differences, I'm sure, but like across a lot of demographic categories, those independent voters tended to, on the balance, tip in Trump's direction. And there were even some, you know, you talk about Nevada, where we were seeing Nevada has party registration. And so you can see what percent of Republicans versus Democrats, for example, have early voted. And I was emailing with a colleague, the Nevada numbers out of Republicans in the days before the election were huge. There were just, you know, early voting and sort of record numbers. Early voting is not a thing Republicans did in 2020.
Right.
And so I was looking at that saying, boy, unless independents in Nevada, you know, break, I don't know, 60-40, 65-35 for Harris, Nevada is going to go Trump's way. So in some of those states that have party registration and where you can see these early voting numbers and that don't have same day registration,
yeah.
Minnesota, Wisconsin is always, you know, a little bit of a wild card because who knows who's going to show up and register on election
right.
day.
Mm-hmm.
In states that don't have that election day registration, we can have a little bit more certainty about what things are going to look like.
Do you have a feel for how many independent voters are out there?
It's a great question. And the question is, who's truly independent?
Mm-hmm.
So when we ask this question on a survey, so partisanship is an identity, just like Badger fan is an identity, right? It's sort of, it's really a matter of who you are and it colors how you see the world around you. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when we ask this on a survey, we'll usually ask like a 5-point or 7-point question, you know, are you Republican, independent, Democrat? When we ask it that way, a substantial chunk, a plurality of voters will say that they're independent.
Hmm.
When you push folks a little bit and say, well, do you lean one way or another? Then you'll start to see people really break off and fall into Republican and Democratic categories. Now, here's the key thing. When people break off and identify as I lean Democrat or I lean Republican, they behave just like strong partisans, right? Those leaners look a lot like partisans. So part of the devil's in the detail how you actually ask the survey question, but those party identities still kind of rule the day.
This isn't quite what we asked you here to talk about, but since you are a political psychologist, I'm going to ask this anyway. The early voting among Republicans, that is a shift. That was not something that happened, I think, ever before now. Do you have any insight into what changed?
I think Trump endorsed early voting.
Oh,
I mean, I think folks were following signals. I think before 2020, there was a lot of bluster around like, you know, casting doubt on the legitimacy of mail-in ballots and all the other different forms of early voting, the different drop-off sites. I think Trump probably recognized that was a strategic mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, changed his tune on that a little bit and the results are pretty clear. There were also some like interesting investments in the ground game, among Republicans. There was even like some outsourcing to third party vendors who were doing the mobilization activity and things like that. And so I think the details of that sort of messaging also matter.
Yeah. Okay. In July, President Biden left the presidential race and decided not to run for a second term, and you know, immediately endorsed Vice President Harris. And then Harris came and selected Governor Tim Walz as a running mate in early August. The Democratic ticket certainly had plenty of money. New York Times reported that the Harris-Walz campaign spent $1.5 billion in 15 weeks. The Harris-Walz campaign seemed to have momentum after the Democratic convention in the third week of August, but ultimately Trump prevailed, again sweeping the seven swing states. Let's talk about what went wrong for the Harris-Walz campaign and what went right for the Trump-Vance campaign. First, would the Democratic Party have been better off having a primary to select a candidate over running the candidate that was endorsed by President Biden? Do you think there was a stronger candidate than Kamala Harris in the party's bullpen?
So I don't know if it would have been possible to run a primary, given the compressed time frame, given the complexity of running elections.
About 4 months.
Yeah. And we have, you have a different electoral process, right, in every single state. A lot of those states are controlled by Republicans. And so whether there would, you know, need to be a separate budget allocation to even administer that election. I think that's sort of that question's sort of like interesting to noodle on, whether a primary would have been useful. But
do hear that though.
I don't know if it would have been. I certainly have heard it. I don't know if it's like just a practically like feasible thing. We can here's what we can speculate on. We could speculate on what was the effect of having a brand new candidate, who voters knew very, very little about, enter the race early on. And in some ways, it might have been a benefit, because Harris was able to just like sort of muster kind of a brand identity very, very rapidly.
Yes.
But that also gave the Trump campaign an opportunity, I think, to sort of try to characterize her. And also, I think, you know, the boots on the ground part of election campaigns, this is probably a theme I'll come back to a lot today, really, really matters. Harris actually did a pretty good job setting up campaign offices, front offices in swing states. I think that's a really important feature of a campaign. But given how late she entered the race, it might have been too little too late, right? Did we really have, you know, could we have been in June and July starting to mobilize voters already, starting to do that voter outreach, just wasn't able to pull that off.
So do you know, I mean, when Biden stepped down, what I saw was a swell in enthusiasm from the Democrats, right? You don't think that translated to boots on the ground?
Well, I'm talking about things like staff.
Yeah.
You know, and right, certainly like there were some volunteers, but it happened so late in the game.
I see.
Right. So, you know, really lost out on opportunities in April, you know, in May to be already doing that voter education and trying to like encourage early voting and trying to persuade voters. Trump just had a bit of a running start.
He had a bigger machine. Well, he didn't have a bigger machine.
He didn't have a bigger machine, but he had. He was able to spread that out over, you know, many more months.
Yeah. All right.
Harris was endorsed by Biden in July, but then did not speak to the press for weeks. Then once she did speak to the press, she made some head-scratching statements. As an example, when asked on a national television program what she would do differently than the Biden administration during the past 4 years, she said, and I'm paraphrasing, that nothing came to mind that she would change. How much did not talking to the press right away, followed by not articulating her own vision in interviews, hurt her candidacy, do you think?
Yeah, so let me kind of agree in part and disagree in part maybe with the premises. I think as far as not talking to the press early on, I think that's a missed opportunity. Mm-hmm. She needed to, for the reasons we just talked about, she was sort of an unknown commodity.
Right.
In part because she hasn't been a particularly visible vice president either, other than the border stuff, which was not a winning issue. And so she needed to come out with sort of a strong message, a strong vision early on. We live in a highly segmented media environment right now, where it's not like it was in the 80s and the 90s, where you and I were probably watching the same television programs. Right now,
we were kids. There were probably four channels on TV.
Four channels, yeah. And now it's, you know, some folks have, you know, their favorite YouTube channel or their favorite TikTok host that they're watching. Other folks are listening to podcasts. And so it requires a full court press to really blanket all of these different media environments and pick up all. And that did not happen early on. It was a really risk averse strategy. I think maybe, you know, to speculate, maybe Harris was seeing some of the goodwill that was coming her way, saying, right, I don't need this. But I do think that was a mistake. As far as the gaffes, I would say, I think that's probably a little bit of a false equivalency, in part because we could spend an hour running through Trump gaffes that didn't hurt him. And so I don't want to say that the nothing came to mind that she would change him. And in part too, because, you know, vice president, she's still a member of the Biden administration to this day. And so I think you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, because if she would have come out and started criticizing the Biden administration, the question then would have been, well, why didn't you criticize this policy earlier? Why didn't you try to be a vehicle for change within the administration? Right. And so I don't really buy the gaffe thing. But I do think you're right about the sort of establishing that candidate brand identity early on.
Mm-hmm. On election day, one of the most Googled questions was, did Joe Biden drop out of the presidential election? And right there, I mean, I'm trying to find a way to phrase this as a question instead of just a statement. But don't we lay that at the feet of the Harris-Walz campaign for things like you were saying, like not talking to the press right away and not keeping a higher profile?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can attribute it to all sorts of different factors. Yeah. I think the Harris-Walz campaign is one of them. I think the media is another one. I think, you know, if I wanted to get really big picture, we could just talk about civic education in this country and the need to inform folks, not just about, you know, what are the three branches of government, but how do you get involved in the political process? How do you become an informed consumer of information rather than a misinformed consumer of information? So
I would love to have that conversation with you sometime, by the way.
Let's do it. Yeah.
All right.
Did the Harris team make a mistake selecting Tim Walz as a running mate? He was brought in with the thinking that he could bolster support in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. The Democrats lost all three, and further, Walz lost his home counties in southern Minnesota on election night. How much does the vice presidential pick Walz in this case matter? Would Governor Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania have perhaps been a better selection? Whitmer out of Michigan, Pritzker out of Illinois. What do you think about the Walz pick?
I still think it's a good pick. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of this gets to this question: is there anything Harris could have done? Mm-hmm. And I'm not convinced there is. Despite, you know, I think we'll spend the rest of this hour talking about maybe little mistakes or campaign made. But, you know, would have that made enough of a difference to sway really the broader trend that we saw? I kind of doubt it. I think Walz early on generated some goodwill. Mm-hmm. I think he, you know, has this sort of down-to-earth communication style. I don't think he performed especially well in the debates. Mm-hmm. But all this gets to, you know, there's political science research. Do vice presidential candidates matter? Right. Probably not. Can vice presidential candidates deliver a state? Probably not. Could Shapiro have delivered Pennsylvania given his popularity there? Maybe, but that's just one state. And then, you know, that would have probably cost him potentially in other places. Shapiro had his own negatives, I guess that go with him. Do debates matter? I think is another question. Maybe in the short term, I think the Biden debate led him to drop out. But broadly speaking, when we look back over debates over the last 20 years, we can think of all these great debate moments, mm-hmm. right? We could spend an hour on that too. Great moments in presidential debates or horrible moments in presidential debates. But generally, you know, you might see a little blip in public opinion after a debate, and then it kind of erodes. So I think Walls was a perfectly sensible pick. I think in general he did his job as the vice presidential candidate, which is to be sort of an attack dog. Mm-hmm. He did a good job of being an attack dog without seeming nasty. That's sort of his charm. Right. I don't know that it would have made any difference at the end of the day.
Despite the polling that was out there, I could see and feel momentum in the weeks leading up to the election for Trump Vance. The Harris-Walls campaign was in a bit of a jam because of some of the Biden-Harris administration's policies. Considering the economy, everyone understands higher prices, putting gas in their cars, heating costs, groceries, certainly, among other things. And consider the failure of immigration policy. You know, that's a lifetime worth of problems for both parties.
That's an entire show.
But on a TV each night, you could watch walking caravans, people swimming across rivers, buses and planes of migrants coming to the U.S. No cohesive policy. That puts stress on schools and hospitals and shelters and blue-collar workers. Were the economy and immigration too much to overcome for Harris-Walls? Were there other issues that voters believe Trump would be better on as president in addition to the economy and immigration, perhaps bringing a conclusion to the wars in the Middle East and Eastern Europe, or other issues that you believe were decisive for the Republicans?
Yeah, so let me back up a little bit and try to take this question in chunks. Mm-hmm. When we try to evaluate the success or failure of presidential campaigns, one thing political scientists like to talk about are the fundamentals, mm-hmm. right? There's always sort of fundamentals. It is the hand that you're dealt at the start of a campaign that you have to live with. And the two big fundamentals are presidential popularity and the economy. Mm-hmm. Okay. Presidential popularity, Biden is not a popular president right now. I think, you know, there are probably things Biden could have done over the last 4 years to message more effectively and to boost that number, but he's, you know, Harris, in part because she is so closely tied to the Biden presidency, mm-hmm. I think there's very little she could do to run from that, from Biden's record. She was going to be tied to that no matter what. On the economy, we talked before the election too. I think the economy was sending some ambiguous signals. When political scientists try to model election, do this election forecasting business, a lot of times what they do is look at like second quarter GDP growth. Mm-hmm. It's highly predictive. Now, you probably can't feel that at the grocery store, mm-hmm. right? The same way you could maybe feel the price of you know, basic necessities. But second quarter GDP growth was above average, if I'm not mistaken. Unemployment is really low. The economy was adding jobs. The stock market's running high. So there are plenty of good economic indicators out there. Consumers did not have confidence that the economy was headed in the right direction, though. Mm-hmm. Again, why is that, given some of these other positive signals, but there's also negative signals? You know, I think that's a messaging failure, again, on the part of the Biden administration over the last couple of years. So what do we do with all of that? I'm trying to remember what the question was. Oh, was the economy and immigration too much to overcome for Harris and Walls? I mean, I think that Harris was dealt a very, very difficult hand, and I don't know if there's any way she could have overcome those sort of economic fundamentals and Biden's low popularity. So there's some research on this. And by the way, I'm sort of paraphrasing this political scientist, John Sides, who I really like, who's done some public writing since then. I want to give credit because he says, when you see a big picture trend, and virtually every county in America switched from, you know, voted more Republican than it did 4 years ago. So we see this really big picture trend across the entire country. Look for a big picture explanation, not a small picture explanation. And so I think that's where the economy really, really matters here.
Do the wars in the Middle East and Ukraine matter here?
I think, I think among maybe a small subset of voters, yeah. Those are the most important issue. Mm-hmm. I think Harris probably lost a little bit of support to, you know, third party candidates like Jill Stein, mm-hmm. because she was sort of yoked to Biden administration policy. We still don't know, by the way, and this goes to the branding thing, exactly what the Harris administration might have done differently, in part because a vice president needs to sort of be true to the administration that they're a part of. But I don't think those issues, I mean, I think, you know, the old James Carville, it's the economy, stupid. I think that really won the day for a lot of folks. Now, what could Harris have done differently? There's this book by Lynn Vavrick. It was published a number of years ago. It basically says, what do candidates do when they're with the economic hand that they're dealt? If you're dealt a good economic hand, you run what she calls a clarifying campaign. Mm-hmm. Let's just point it out to everybody that the economy is really good and we're the incumbent administration. If you are dealt a bad economic hand, right? If consumer confidence is low, if you're, if the price of goods is high, you run what she calls an insurgent campaign. It's where you try to run on something completely different, right? Kind of, and that's a tough hand to play out. But we try to go in, and I think it's what Harris did. She ran on abortion. She talked a lot about democracy. Mm-hmm. It was an important issue for Democrats. It was not enough to overcome, you know, the economic fundamentals.
So you think independent voters there were, all right, we're not talking about abortion. Let's focus on the economy. What do you think independent voters were on?
Yeah, yeah, I think it was those sort of basic economic issues. It was, and I also don't think independent voters are paying attention to things like, I mean, you mentioned immigration. Immigration rates had actually slowed considerably in the year leading up to the election. When we talk about things like border crossings at the southern border, it slowed considerably from where we're at. All sorts of indicators that the economy was picking up. I think it takes a really, really sophisticated voter to hone in on those things. And for partisans, who are the people that pay the most attention to the news, as we talked about before, you see the world through your partisan lens. And so we're always going to be processing information that way. I think for most of those independent voters, it's as simple as going to the store and not being pleased that it's more expensive to buy a mattress than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. From the Trump side, what were the keys to President Trump's campaign success? Do endorsements from Bobby Kennedy and Elon Musk help him? Did appearing on large podcasts, you know, the world's biggest podcasts, like the Joe Rogan Experience, help him? Did he make inroads into reunion or into the unions? He was certainly a relentless campaigner. What about Trump's campaign put him over the top?
Yeah, so let me try to take it in pieces here. Trump ran a clarifying campaign. There were things that were bugging voters, and he reminded folks of those things. He reminded folks that the economy was strong during his presidency, for most of his presidency, and he reminded voters that the price of goods is high right now. I think it's that simple. I think as far as the other things, I think so the Joe Rogan thing,
yeah.
I think that is a net positive. The ability to, again, we live in this highly segmented media environment, right. The ability to go and reach different pockets of voters, I think, is really important. I think anybody who's campaigning in 2026 and 2028 needs to display those types of chops, right? To talk to different groups of voters, these sort of narrow cast messages, right? Mm-hmm. It's not everybody. It's, you said Joe Rogan's a very popular podcast, but it's not everybody that listens to Joe Rogan, right? But to start to make appeals with those different groups of voters, I think, is really important. The endorsements thing. So there's all kinds of research, as you can imagine, in political science on whether endorsements matter. Averaging across all of it, probably not that much. In 2008, when Oprah endorsed Obama, Oprah's more like, Oprah's more of an institution than a human being. Oprah's like hugely important.
She's a brand.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, there's some research suggesting the Oprah endorsement actually made a difference for Obama. As far as, you know, Kennedy or Musk, I don't think it was hugely important just based on the prior research. You know, the Taylor Swift thing.
I was just going to bring that up
for Harris. Again, my answer would be the same, but it's also kind of an empirical question, given the kind of unique demographic that Taylor Swift operates in, which is sort of appealing to young folks who are probably going to be also first-time voters. I think that's sort of an interesting, interesting question, you know, given, and so it'll be interesting to see if that has, you know, I'm sure there's going to be about a bazillion political science papers that'll come out on Taylor Swift in the next couple of years.
There'll be books
on the Taylor Swift effect, but, or lack of an effect. Like I said, most of the research suggests these endorsements don't matter. I think the real answer to the question is that Trump ran a clarifying campaign on economic fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do negative political ads on TV work? I mean, there seem to be a lot of them during campaigns. The Harris campaign or surrogates about Trump potentially taking away reproductive rights and health care from women. Trump campaigning about Harris's support for transgender surgeries for, you know, inmates. Does this type of advertising work with voters? The Washington Post, New York Times, and The Hill have all had recent articles suggesting that it is effective. So, Chris, I'm asking you.
Yeah, we could do this as great debates in American politics, or in the study of political science, I should say, because, you know, the question of negative ads is another one of those. There's kind of, you know, three different ways that we might think about an ad working. It might demobilize supporters from the other side, make them just a little less enthusiastic and they don't turn out. It might mobilize supporters on the other side. It might anger them so much they decide to turn out, and it might persuade. The evidence is kind of mixed, and it really depends on the content of the specific ad. I think most of the literature out there, most of the research that's been done suggests that when people get angry, they are more likely to turn out. It probably doesn't have the demobilizing effect that we might think of. Although some people say, like, oh, I'm so sick of all these negative ads, I'm done with politics.
Right. You hear that a lot.
You hear that a lot, but that's not actually what happens. Yeah. I think probably the net effect of all of this advertising is mobilization. They also play an informational role. Sometimes it's misinformation, but voters do learn from ads, especially those kind of low information voters, people that kind of pay attention to politics just some of the time. They're going to learn things from these ads. Typically, I think it probably, maybe bumped up turnout a little bit, got the base riled up a little bit. But I also, I'm, you know, that first thing I mentioned, persuasion, I'm a little bit skeptical, that negative ads can have a huge persuasive effect. I think most of their work comes in the form of kind of getting our blood boiling a little bit and making us more likely to participate on election day.
Yeah.
I think you probably just answered this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Staying with the theme of negativity in political campaigns, rhetoric. Recall when Hillary Clinton in the fall of 2016 said during the election for president that you could put half of Trump supporters in a basket of deplorables. That didn't help her. Biden had a moment like that recently before the 2024 election, calling Trump supporters garbage. He later tried to walk that back. This negative, demeaning rhetoric, and of course it's on both sides, does it bring out people that wouldn't vote?
Yeah, I mean, maybe at the margins. You know, on the same token, we saw far higher turnout in 2020, right? Where we're not, we maybe don't remember some of those, like, kind of the more vicious of those attacks. So I, you know, like I said, I think at the margins it can upset people, maybe to the point where they're slightly more likely to turn out. Angry voters can be motivated voters. Yeah. But this is making for bad radio, but I'm going to keep coming back to this thing. It's the economy. Like I think at the end of the day, far fewer voters turned out. It was still a high turnout election, but far fewer turned out in 2024 than in 2020. And those that did were motivated by the price of goods.
Yeah. No, I agree with that completely, absolutely. But one of the other things that I've been wondering, you know, Kamala Harris is Asian and Black. Did her heritage or even the fact that she's a woman have an effect on this whole thing?
Yeah, I think this is another one of these questions that political scientists are going to be looking at really carefully in the next couple of years. There was, you know, there after 2008, a lot of folks said, well, we now live in a post-racial era. You can see day after that. And that is 100% false, right?
We knew that 3 days later.
Yeah. So, you know, can racism, can sexism play a role in candidate evaluation? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think what we're going to be finding out is the extent to which those things mattered in the minds of voters. There's some interesting work after the 2016 Trump presidency that suggested that racism and sexism were an important motivating factor in vote choice. Again, for your listeners, this is not all voters, right? Mm-hmm. But this is suggesting that those attitudes, when we try to measure them on survey, even when we try to control for everything else in the world, partisanship and views of the economy and, you know, religiosity and everything else, those attitudes were still predictive of vote choice. And so as political scientists, we look at this and we say, it seems like there's something there. I'm quite certain that those same studies are going to be replicated, and we'll see, you know, the extent to which those attitudes were still predictive, particularly given kind of the historic nature of the Harris candidacy, and that it was the first African-American, Asian-American candidate or female candidate running for office.
Mm-hmm. For our listeners, you're listening to our post-election coverage of 2024 on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1, broadcasting from beautiful downtown Northfield, Minnesota. I'm Rich Larson. My co-host is Joe Moravchik. We're talking today with Professor Chris Chapp of St. Olaf College about the 2024 presidential election and what we can learn from it. Chris, let's talk about the polling. You and I had a really good conversation about that. You and I and Logan had a really good conversation about that a few days before the election. A lot of polls out there, a lot of different variations. Every one of them was close. A day before the election in the swing states, based on polling averages, Trump had slight leads in North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada. Harris had slight leads in Wisconsin and Michigan. Pennsylvania was tied. There was a poll in Iowa that had Harris leading there by 3 points. She lost Iowa by 13 points. What did the pollsters get right, and what did they get wrong in the lead-up to the whole thing?
I think what we know now is it is very difficult to poll in an election where Trump is on the ballot.
Yeah.
And it is not for lack of trying. You know, as we talked about in our pre-election conversation, pollsters really, really changed their methodology in 2024 to try to reach those Trump voters. And, you know, I think part of it might be the challenge when you know, a candidate like Trump is highly skeptical of mm-hmm. media organizations, right? And then a media organization calls and asks for your opinion. You know, what are you going to do?
Right.
Probably hang up the phone or not even answer. And so, it's been really difficult to poll, in elections where Trump's on the ballot, and in elections like 2022, the pollsters were actually like historically close. Mm. They did a really good job. So, I will own it that I was actually, I happen to really like that Iowa poll in part because she's kind of old school.
Mm-hmm.
With the way the poll is conducted, it relies on a lot of telephone calls as opposed to recruiting subjects over the internet mm-hmm. and some of the newer methodologies that I'm somewhat skeptical of. But at the end of the day, I mean, you're right. That poll did not work. I think the polling industry is going to need to have a hard look at itself and figure out what it can do to get better samples if it wants to stay in business.
The one thing I took away from that conversation that we had was that polling can work and polling is important, but presidential polling is just it can be an exercise in futility.
You know, I think I'm a believer in the value of polling,
mm-hmm.
and I'm a believer in it for reasons that we've talked about. I think several times in this conversation already, I've said, well, political scientists are going to be taking a look at this, you know, because there's some really, really interesting, important questions about the role of negative ads, about the role of endorsements, about the role of descriptive characteristics of the candidate, like race and gender. These are all really important things to learn. We can look back at polls and we can learn something about this. And so we can learn something about our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
I think using polls as a tool for prediction is a very different type of question. And I think it's one that's sort of fraught, and maybe it's what we all want. We want that sort of horse race. We want to treat politics as a sporting event and say, hey, who's in the lead right now? But I think that's sort of a problematic exercise, using polls as kind of this predictive tool.
Yeah. What was the turnout like this year? We were talking about that a little bit. What was the turnout like compared to 2020 and 2016? How did turnout factor in Trump's win? Who stayed home?
Yeah, so Trump overperformed his 2020 mm-hmm. numbers by a little, not by a lot, but he clearly helped get more voters to the polls. Whether that was encouraging early voting, whether that was partly just feeding off economic factors, I think. Whether it was, you know, as I alluded to earlier, he relied on some third party vendors to try to do some get out the vote type work. Mm-hmm. All of those things probably combined to help him. Harris, at the time of this interview, and these numbers will change a little bit, but mm-hmm. she had something like 74 million voters. Biden was up over 81 million. And so that's the difference in the election right there. A lot of people just stayed home, or a lot of, you know, the folks who are kind of, you know, maybe they participate every 4 years, but don't participate in the midterms. Kind of these sometimes voters, oftentimes those folks are independents who probably flip their preference. Is there anything Harris could have done different? I mentioned earlier, she did actually a really good job putting field offices in swing states. I think she avoided some of the problems the Clinton campaign had mm-hmm. in 2016. There's this interesting book out by Danny Hayes and Sean Wire, two political scientists, who look at this question. And they argue there's a 1% gain in two-party vote share for every field office that a candidate has.
Really?
Yeah, it's a huge number. Now, she was a little bit late to the game, mm-hmm. and so maybe that mattered. But I'm a big believer in this sort of boots on the ground campaigning. And if you had pushed me before the election, by the way, I probably would have said this may be the difference maker. She, in swing states, Harris had more of these field offices than Trump did. But I think it is plausible to argue that had she not done that work, she would have lost by even more.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. There's been a lot of discussion since the election about how different demographics voted. For example, we've read that Trump earned the votes of more Black and Latino men than prior Republican candidates. Harris had strong support from college-educated white women. Let's break this down. How did the candidates do with college-educated versus non-college-educated voters? How did different age groups vote and different genders? How did different racial groups vote? Did Trump indeed get more votes from Black and Latino men? And how about Black women? How did suburban, I'm throwing a lot at you.
Yeah.
So suburban versus rural voters vote. You know, basically, who voted for what, Chris?
Sure. So first off, I mean, Trump overall sort of increased across the board. I mean, I think that's like the main, like the first takeaway, right? Is he improved a little bit with everybody. Or almost everybody. Let's start with, I think the first one you mentioned was college educated versus non-college educated.
Correct.
This is the often referred to as the diploma divide. Mm-hmm. It really materialized for the first time in 2016. And in fact, it's probably part of the reason why the 2016 polls got it so wrong. Mm-hmm. Trump continued to kind of hold that margin. So we're seeing this diploma divide still present for a number of elections now. I would venture to say this is going to be sort of a continuing part of these electoral coalitions, where Democrats are going to get more college-educated voters and Republicans are going to get fewer college-educated voters. Mm-hmm. I suspect that we've seen this pattern for enough elections in a row now that I suspect that that's going to be sort of a feature of the party coalitions moving forward. Mm. Yeah.
Is that a shift or is that new? The diploma divide.
Yeah. 2016. I think is really when you saw it materialize for the first time.
And I guess I'm thinking over the course of, you know, 50 years.
Yeah. Over the course of 50 years. Yeah. Things have definitely changed.
Yeah.
You've seen the salience of other demographic categories, go down. Income and mm-hmm. voting, for example, mm-hmm. Might not have the same predictive power it once did.
All right. What about by race?
Yeah, so this is interesting. Mm-hmm. African-American voters maybe made up maybe 7% of those folks voted for Trump in 2020. It's up to something like 16% now, mm-hmm. Per the exit polls. And by the way, I should mention, exit polls, we have to be, I should put a big caveat with everything I say about exit polls. Because of the way exit polls are conducted, we're going in and pollsters are going into specific precincts to try to capture a snapshot that will look roughly representative. But as we know, different precincts can have really unique characteristics. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be careful about overinterpreting an exit poll. That is a huge jump in African-American support, mostly driven by African-American men.
Mm-hmm.
A data point is not a trend. And so whether or not this will be a feature of American politics going forward or whether it's a feature mm-hmm. of a bad economy, I would probably tend to lean on the latter, that it's a feature of the economic circumstances. But, I think it's like an important thing. I think it's an important thing to watch. It's mm-hmm. really, an important sort of chipping away of that racial coalition that the Democratic Party has had.
Right.
Latino voters, 37%-ish in 2020 voted for Trump, up to 43%.
Hmm.
So that's a big jump. That was across gender for mm-hmm. Latino voters.
Mm-hmm.
How do we interpret these results? There's a political scientist who studies race and politics, Efrain Perez, who wrote not too long ago that polarization might finally be kind of catching up
mm-hmm.
With voters of color. These are heterogeneous groups. African-American voters, Latino voters are not uniformly liberal, often conservative on a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so we might be seeing some sorting out,
mm-hmm.
right, where folks are realigning on the basis of ideology. But again, I'd also just sort of caution against reading a single data point as a trend. When I think about the Latino electorate, particularly thinking about exit polls, I think about a kind of problematic 2004 national exit poll. So in that poll, George W. Bush got 44% of Hispanic voters in that poll. Okay. Huge number. Everybody was calling it a realignment. He had some policies in Texas that were popular with Latino voters and had done a lot of very intentional outreach. That number was back down to 31% in 2008.
Yeah.
So, and that exit poll, by the way, oversampled voters in Miami, which tends to be more Cuban and tends to be more Republican.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if we use this broad Hispanic category, right, it looks like we were representative. But if we look at the specific makeup of the voters, these were folks who were probably Republicans already.
Yeah.
So anyway, lots to unpack there. But, it's a fairly startling number, actually, given racial coalitions over the last 30 years. But it's also, again, like I just pump the brakes a little bit anytime I look at one data point.
Right. It's got to put the fear, even if it is one data point, though, it's got to put the fear of God into Democrats.
Oh, yeah.
Because Democrats have always sort of claimed minorities as part of their foundation.
Democrats need at least, 90% of African Americans voting in order to win elections.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's bring it closer to home. There are any number of ways to look at the state of Minnesota and voting trends, but right here in the second congressional district, does this race reflect any trends in Minnesota or nationwide? Angie Craig defeated Joe Tarab by 13 points
mm-hmm.
and is going back to the House, I think, for her fourth term now. So what do you see in that race?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked about this. And I actually had students out polling in the second congressional district
mm-hmm.
all over the place, Lakeville, Apple Valley. We did one precinct here in Northfield, Prior Lake, Cottage Grove. So we're kind of all over the place. We have a great survey, 650-ish voters in the second district who took our survey. So so I'm well poised. If I don't have the answer off the top of my head, I can probably look it up in our survey. What can I say about the second district? So the first thing is, it's kind of moved, I think, from being a toss up to really a lean Democratic district. When do incumbents lose?
Right.
Incumbents lose after a redistricting. Angie Craig has survived that. Mm-hmm. Incumbents lose after their first election. Right. Mm-hmm. They're always most vulnerable then. Angie Craig survived that. And incumbents lose when there's some sort of big national trend moving in the other direction. And Angie Craig has now survived that. She ran ahead of Harris in the district. Mm-hmm. We looked at split ticket voters. She got something like 10% of her vote, her support, in our poll from folks who also supported Trump for president. Hmm. Right. So
it does not surprise me.
Yeah. So I think Angie Craig has sort of done the work, to build her coalition in the second district. And the other thing about the second is just sort of demographic changes on her side, the suburbs. Despite the movement in 2024, I think the suburbs on the balance are sort of moving in a blue direction. Mm-hmm. And that's where most of the second district is. It's in Eagan, it's in Apple Valley. That's going to be the source of Craig's support for years to come. And she's winning in those places.
Okay. Chris, conclude for us your overall thoughts about the 2024 presidential race. And any trend predictions you might have for future elections in 26 and 28.
You know, it's interesting when you say trend, there's this idea in political science I've been thinking about for a long time, that I actually just taught on the other day. So it's top of the mind. The idea of what are called thermostatic trends in public opinion. Okay. You think about public opinion like a thermostat. Right. And so things get a little too hot, you cool it down, and then it's too cool and you turn it back up again. Mm-hmm. And public opinion on certain issues works a lot like that. So we saw broad support, I would say, for a change. Mm-hmm. I think that's what voters voted on, is a change on the economy. Will there be sort of, broad based support for Trump's economic program, for Trump's immigration program? I would expect voters to turn the dial down on those things now that he's been elected. I would have said the exact same thing about Harris had Harris won.
Sure.
I think we're gonna see, voters kind of calibrate themselves back toward the middle a little bit. For that reason, I will not make any predictions about 2026 or 2028, except that things are going to look a little different.
Trump has broken so many ideals that there are like the things that were sort of held sacred by political watchers. The person who spends the most money wins the election. Well, that that was out the window in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that you campaign from the edge and govern from the middle, that kind of went out.
Mm-hmm.
But he got reelected. I mean, or not reelected, but he was elected again. It feels like it's not, Trump feels like a paradigm shift to me. I mean, he really feels like there's reorganization happening in the political system of America.
Makes it tough to teach parties in elections.
Sometimes we'll
put up, I'll put a theory up on the board or whatever, and I'll say, let's explain why this doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. Because you're right. There is sort of a paradigm shift. I think there's things to watch. I mean, I think, things that I think about in addition to this idea of thermostatic public opinion, I'm thinking a lot about realignment, right? Are the party coalitions fundamentally changing?
Mm-hmm.
I think about, issue preferences and governance. I wonder how Democrats are going to react. Are Democrats going to sort of tack to the middle, or are Democrats going to advance, more progressive priorities, sort of a Bernie Sanders type agenda? I don't know, the direction that's headed. But that's like, that's where the debate is at, I think, within both parties right now.
Yeah.
Let's wrap up our conversation here. Chris, where can our listeners find your book and learn more about the Institute for Freedom and Community, of which you are an integral part of at St. Olaf College.
Yeah, so the Institute for Freedom and Community, you can navigate to from the St. Olaf website. We have a ton of free events that are open to the public. Mm. I would, in particular, if I could give a plug to Julia Azari, who is a phenomenal scholar on parties from Marquette. She'll be giving a free open to the public talk in Viking Theater at St. Olaf, 6 p.m. on December 9th. That's a Monday. So I would encourage members of the community to attend that. It'll be a great diagnosis of, sort of what happened and where are we going. And the book, new book just out, called Moral Issues. And so that could be,
number two,
That's book number two. Yeah. Co-authored with Paul Gorin at the University of Minnesota and, the Chicago University Press website. But you can buy that pretty much anywhere. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, that's fantastic, Chris. It's been a busy election season here at KYMN, and I know that I can speak for Joe to thank you, Chris, for joining us today and providing great, great political insight into this past election.
Oh, great questions. I always learn a lot every time I come here.
Amazing where those great questions can come from.
Professor Chapp has joined us on prior programs here on KYMN. If you would like to access those programs, go to the KYMN website and type in the search bar, Christopher Chapp. Multiple programs will appear.
KYMNradio.net.
The goal of our election coverage programming over the past months has been to provide meaningful, in-depth conversations with our candidates. Today, a political expert. It's really been a neat experience, Rich. We started this in July.
Yeah, yeah.
And went all the way up to the last week before the election, and now we're doing a summary.
I can't thank you, Joe, enough for the hours and hours of volunteer time you have put into this show. I have been very proud of the coverage that KYMN provided over the course of the election. You were a massive part of that, so thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
I really appreciate it. So, Chris, thank you, sir.
Absolutely.
I'm Rich Larson. My co-host is Joe Moravchik. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1 in Northfield. Thank you for joining us today, and have a great week, everybody.